Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to The Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hello and welcome to Republic Forces Radio Network, where we talk all things Clone Wars. I'm Jonathan, and tonight we're going to be discussing Season 5, Episode 16, The Lawless. Now, this may have been the most anticipated episode of this season thus far. Joining me tonight to discuss it are Barrett.
Hey, everybody. It's Barrett, Master Collect Them All from the forums, your Swan Holocron Enhancer. And what an exciting show, Jonathan. Again, I'm just so happy to be on this roundtable to discuss this great episode.
Jerry.
Hey, Jonathan. Nate. Barrett. How are you? I'm just keeping it chill.
Jerry's like, you can kill me, but you'll never destroy me.
And Nathan.
Hey, everybody. We're back.
This is the final episode of the Night Brothers Death Watch arc, and a lot of loose strings are tied up. I love this episode. It may be my favorite episode of the entire series. But what did you guys think? And we're going to reverse order and start with Nathan.
I think I would agree with you. It's probably the best Clone Wars episode that we've perhaps ever gotten. I mean, it really was up there as far as pulling the strings together, giving us references to everything from the classic trilogy to, I think, in some camera angles, maybe even Moulin Rouge with the other Satine's death and Ewan McGregor. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff jam-packed into this episode. I find it on about the third viewing, I start to question why, you know, Obi-Wan really didn't manage to do anything he set out to do. He kind of got his butt kicked big time more than at any other time, even in last season. But kind of taking that aside, I have to say that even still with Obi-Wan winding up being the one getting his butt kicked throughout the episode, it stands out as the pinnacle of the series so far.
You know, if anyone had any thoughts about Darth Maul coming back as being a really stupid thing to do. Like, come on, he's been dead since Phantom Menace, cut in half, went down the shaft, dead and gone. What does this show think it's doing by bringing Darth Maul back? It's desperation, it's a gimmick, what have you. And hey, I wasn't always on board. But for anybody who was negative about it or doubted it, this episode is the single justification of why it was a good thing to bring Darth Maul back, just so you could have this episode. That's how much I enjoyed it. This, by far, the best episode they've done. By far, the best arc we've seen. The most Star Wars-y. Just the most exciting thing we've seen in this series. And God help the episode that has to follow this one.
You know, I'm going to have to concur with the rest of you. I mean, this episode really felt Star Wars-y. You know, it felt like Return of the Jedi-ish, Revenge of the Sith kind of episode. The lightsaber battles, the way that you had the Emperor, you know, because he was definitely the Emperor, Darth Sidious, that we see. All the way to we find out Bo-Katan is Satine's sister. It was just amazing. Absolutely amazing. I cannot wait to see what's going to happen in the future. And I'm hoping that we have one or two more seasons. Whatever's going on with Lucasfilm and Disney, I hope they work this out. Because we need to see what happens to Maul.
But now, Barrett, having said that about the whole Satine and Bo-Katan being sisters, whose kid is Corky? Is there another sibling? Is he supposed to be the son of Bo-Katan? I never did quite figure that little piece there out. Do we have any? I mean, I've never seen any continuity information on that. Do we have any info? Have you guys seen anything? Has Filoni popped up something on Facebook I haven't run into? Or is it still a mystery?
He's Obi-Wan's kid.
I've questioned that too. There hasn't been anything, but I when I saw it, I'm like, wait a minute. If Bo-Katan is Satine's sister and Corky is Satine's nephew, or he's her auntie, I mean, maybe it's just an honorary title. You never know.
Well, they need to give him a different title than Corky. I mean, all the rest of them got cool names.
Auntie Satine's first name.
right. But Corky? I mean, that's the Mandalorian name is Corky?
Let's get into the episode because we have a lot of ground to cover. The episode opens after the recap with Satine being broken out of prison by Corky and Bo-Katan. And we get the impression at this point that there is some type of a relationship, a previous relationship between Bo and Satine, as obviously by the end of the episode we find out that they're siblings. But did any of you get the idea that that was where they were going to go with this at that point?
I had no idea. I was totally caught off guard when Obi-Wan says Satine was your sister to Bo-Katan at the end. I didn't know. But when you go back and Monday quarterback it, they have all the signs there. I mean, she looks just like Satine with red hair, basically. So when you go back and see the signs, they're all there. But I was totally fooled. I didn't see it coming at all.
I picked up on it a little bit later. Before it was revealed by Obi-Wan, I kind of figured it out. I mean, they kind of did drop hints through the episode, you know, call my sister, she'll send reinforcements, things like that. I guess when I think about it and I look at this arc as a whole, I think I would have liked if they had dropped hints prior to this.
You know, it's kind of interesting because that wasn't originally going to stay in the episode. Jason Fry, who did the novelization version, the young reader novelization of this, Shadow Conspiracy, talked about how that was one of those lines about the whole, you know, you're the sister, that was actually dropped when he eventually was given the information of what he was supposed to write based on the scripts, and they added it back in, and he was excited to see it. So I'm wondering if that was something that was a last-minute decision just for this episode. I mean, I'm with you. I pretty much picked up on it as soon as he said, you know, ask my sister. It was kind of a, okay, there must be a sister there somewhere, especially since he responds with, who's your sister? But it was not something I would have expected prior to this episode at all. I'm betting it was not something intended until very, very much the last couple minutes.
Well, I guess I'm not convinced yet as to why it matters, why it's important. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe they'll go somewhere with it. But it almost seemed like they're just trying to do a movie callback, because the way Obi-Wan delivers the line reminded me exactly of Anakin's the father, isn't he? I'm so sorry. It was like the exact line, only Satine with Anakin and sister for father. I mean, it was the exact line, and I'm not sure what the significance is or if there's supposed to be one other than, hey, there's a twist.
Well, let me put forth a couple suggestions. One, I would say, first off, on the I'm sorry thing, I love the line, but this time he could at least mean it, because she would not be dead if he hadn't gone there. Basically, he showed up and all hell broke loose and things didn't turn out well for anybody. And the hero of the episode is freaking Sidious. I would say that her being the sister might give us at least one thing, because that means that Bo-Katan has sort of one foot in the new Mandalorians through her sister, one foot in the Death Watch through her previous participation before breaking away from Vizsla. Maybe she could wind up being the new leader of Mandalore, one that can bring the two factions back together. I mean, she has that dual heritage here.
It does justify what we saw last week of why she didn't follow the code and say, oh, I guess Maul's our new leader. There's obviously some family tie that's, oh, maybe not the family tie to Satine in so much as my honor, my loyalty is far more to Mandalore, and what's happening here with Maul is anything but good for our planet.
Well, and I don't want to dwell on this point too much, but when I think back to the original Mandalore episodes where Satine is introduced, and there's some discussion between her and Obi-Wan about how they were hiding, and she was trying to kind of establish herself as the Duchess of Mandalore and, you know, peaceful Mandalorians. And I wonder if Satine was basically going against Bo-Katan, you know, because they were sisters and maybe that there's a lineage there for leadership of Mandalore. So they get out to the landing platform, and this is another point where I see that just the visuals are just superb in this episode. Every so often, there's a shot or a scene that just reminds me just how beautiful they make this series.
And there's more callbacks, right? I mean, they're working in their previous continuity. We've got the Twilight back, which really hasn't been seen in a couple of seasons, I don't think. And we've got Obi-Wan showing up wearing the Rako Hardeen armor. You know, they're picking up all these assets and all these, you know, little tiny side threads and even weaving them into these episodes. There's so many assets they've now created and improved upon that they're a toy box is filled with all kinds of really cool stuff, and now they're getting to use it all at once. You know, gone are the days of, you know, we can't do this because we don't have the character model for it. They can pretty much do just about anything and just have to make a few extra character models along the way, it's sort of starting to feel like.
I love the fact that they brought back the Twilight, and I love the fact that it gives you that Millennium Falcon feel. You know, it's what a hunk of junk! You know, it's leaking oil. You know, it's still as beat up as when we saw it last time. And the Rako Hardeen armor. And It's like, where are they keeping all of this stuff? Do they have a bat cave somewhere with a big penny? It's like they keep everything. I don't know if they're Jedis or if they're hoarders, but it was still cool to see the Rako Hardin Arnor and the Twilight.
Well, we'll get to the Twilight a little bit later, but kind of going back to Satine's breakout, they have a pretty phenomenal chase through the city, and I got vibe of Return of the Jedi, the speeder bike chase. It's just interesting to see this sort of in-flight fighting between the Mandos using their jetpacks.
You know, those jetpacks. I love the jetpacks. You know, and they really kept with the theme of the jetpacks are the Mandalorian's greatest asset, but they're also the Mandalorian's greatest weakness. You can exploit that jetpack. You can kill a Mando. You know, we saw it with Episode 2 with Jango, and we saw it in Return of the Jedi with Boba Fett. So I like the fact that they use these jetpacks to give them an edge, but you can also use it against these Mando warriors. And it's all through this episode.
I mean, it's kind of interesting the way they're naming these Mandalorians that we're seeing here. The ones with the red are being referred to in the production notes and such as Mandalorian Super Commandos, right? The term that goes back to the Marvel series for what were referred to as the Mandalorians that had fought against the Jedi and such. And here we've got the leader of the Mandalorian Super Commandos, their captain, essentially, who's now got the red armor, but also, aside from just taking the red on there to apparently replicate somewhat Maul's color, he's got the built-in horns and such on the helmet. I was actually expecting that to be Maul somehow in the armor, which would seem a little odd. They've redeveloped that. Heck, they even redeveloped for this scene a Jedi communicator. I mean, who knew that Jedi-style, like, little Schick Razor communicators, that's basically the same model she's using here, have cell phone-style signal bars floating on top of them?
So, they recapture Satine after she's able to get her message off, and we jump to the Jedi Temple, where Ki-Adi-Mundi is apparently monitoring communications with Yoda, and they call in Obi-Wan, and they discuss what's going on with Mandalore, and they refer back to, again, the Friend in Need episode, where Ahsoka says that Death Watch is no longer working with the Confederacy. So this kind of addresses one of the conversations we had last week. They say that because it's an internal struggle, it's Death Watch and Mandalore, that they can't get involved because it's a neutral world.
Now, this scene had me a little confused. Okay, why did the Jedi Master, why did they bring in Obi-Wan in the first place? You know, you could say that they brought him in so they knew that they could not intrude, they could not do anything officially, so they brought him in so they knew Obi-Wan would go and help. But then on the other hand, isn't this a little personal? I mean, if you're trying to just walk all of your Jedis off the plank to the dark side, just go ahead and send them into the arms of the woman they love and watch them get killed. I mean, I didn't understand what their motive was, because they kept telling him, no, we can't do anything. No, we can't do anything. Sorry, they're on their own. But wink, wink, we brought you in here, so you go ahead and do it. I was a little confused of this. They had to be able to get that message to Obi-Wan, and I'm very glad she didn't say, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope.
But you expected her to, didn't
but
you?
But I did expect
her to. She was so close.
Yeah. She was. I need you. And I think that that was more appropriate than you're my only hope, but it was still, you know, a callback to episode 4. But it was just still confusing. It's like, why did they bring Obi-Wan into this like that?
They should have had plenty of jurisdiction to send Jedi in here if she had mentioned anything in her, oh, I need help, about, you know, Savage or Maul. Even a description. Hey, there's this freaky black and red horned guy walking around with a lightsaber on his belt who's just basically taken over my planet. Please help me. I mean, she did wind up seeing them at least briefly back in the previous episode when they came down to get Almec, but she leaves out any mention of them in the message, so the Jedi have no reason to say, hey, wait a second, that's Maul, that's Savage, that's the Sith, or the Knight Brothers at least, we should send the people in. I get the idea that maybe they brought Obi-Wan in as a way to try to get him to go because he had at least some stake in the world. Maybe they wanted to, maybe they didn't, but they could have avoided that entire issue if she had just managed to mention the most important part of what it would mean in the grand scheme of things to the Republic to convince them to help in the first place.
You don't think that the Jedi Masters know that Obi-Wan have a relationship with Satine, or had one, and they brought him in because of that?
Well, I mean, they probably brought him in they could, because of that. That's why they sent him before, because they had contact with Satine before. So he was the one back in the original, you know, Mandalorian trilogy we got back in, I guess it was season two. But no, I'm just saying whether or not they brought him in to make him aware or to get his read on a situation versus bringing him in to actually want him to go against their supposed wishes and go intervene since they couldn't officially do it. That's the line I'm not sure which side I fall on.
Well, I can't wait to see Yoda's girlfriend, because obviously has one, because he knows everybody else has one, and he's sending them to him, so...
That's Yaddle.
Yaddle.
It's the reason why Ahsoka leaves the show.
Yeah, you know, the one thing I think the show, as great as it was, the one thing that I think was a little lacking was kind of both how Obi-Wan and Sidious both just show up. I mean, at least we kind of saw the message go to the Jedi Council, but we don't see anything about, did Obi-Wan disobey the Council or Yoda and just go anyway? Did he sneak a ship out? Did he tell Anakin, hey, I gotta go, can you cover for me, take my shift or whatever? Sidious just shows up. I would have enjoyed seeing something with Sidious, for instance. I'm not trying to jump ahead here, but I think there's a parallel of the comparison and the contrast of Obi-Wan getting there and how Sidious gets there. I would have liked to have seen, I don't know, some moment where Sidious, I mean, heck, maybe is even told by the Council, hey, there's a disturbance on Mandalore and we think it's those whatever, but I just think there was something lacking there.
We do get the scene real quick where at least it seems like Sidious slash Palpatine is sensing something. Perhaps he already was keeping tabs on that system and the stuff that was going on there. So we get at least that. It's not like he just shows up out of nowhere. We get a very quick establishing scene that he's aware before he winds up showing up there. And interestingly, in Shadow Conspiracy, though, I'm not sure if this is something that Jason Fry added in. I think it was. Or something that was actually cut out of a script at one point. But there's a point in there, at least, where you get Obi-Wan basically going to Anakin to borrow the Twilight. So we get at least a little bit more of the connection between, you know, how he gets from the Jedi Council briefing chamber room, war room, whatever, to taking off and winding up, you know, on Mandalore in the Twilight.
You know, jumping back to what you guys said about, well, you know, why did they show Obi-Wan? My take on it, and simply my take, was that they wanted Obi-Wan to do something. They knew that they couldn't do it officially, but they also understood it could be a real issue. So it was kind of like the, well, we just wanted to know, and now we're going to look the other way while you do what you need to do. I think it was very sort of like a passive approval or passive permission to go and see what's going on there and to help out Satine. Then we jump back to Mandalore and a discussion between Almec and Maul, and we find out that Satine was allowed to escape. She was allowed to contact the Jedi Temple because he wants to draw in Obi-Wan. And Maul knows that the Jedi can't get involved and that if Obi-Wan comes, he'll come alone. Again, we're seeing the manipulator back in Maul.
That was kind of expected, I think, just the idea that, you know, she got out. Why aren't they guarding her more closely and such? Certainly the later experience seems to have a lot more fight to trying to keep the prisoners escaping from escaping. But what kind of bothered me, when as soon as I saw that jailbreak thing, it struck me, and it didn't strike me until the second or third viewing, and I sat back and thought, you know, speaking of jailbreak, where are all the crime lords in this episode? They just vanished after last week. I mean, granted, in theory, they are either still in prison, supposedly, so they can be presumably released later to do Maul's bidding, or they've been already allowed to leave to go do Maul's bidding. But the whole issue of where are the crime lords just kind of like disappears and gets swallowed up by all the action in the episode. I'd kind of like to know what the heck happened to them.
I would too, but I think you're right, Nathan, that the crime lords were probably going off and expanding Maul's influence to other neutral worlds. It's kind of alluded to, although never overtly stated, but that's how I interpreted it. This is a 22-minute episode. There's a lot to get through. Let's not waste our time with them.
You know, it kind of helps bridge the gap a little bit with what Sidious says to Maul at the end when, you know, Maul's begging for his life and he says, no, I've got other uses for you, however he words it. Kind of makes you wonder if he's going to use Maul to take what he's established and use it to the benefit of the Empire. Because he's going to need to continue to have threats beyond the Clone Wars and the Separatists that will justify him having an empire and being that protector, and I bring peace and all these evil influences. In a lot of ways, Sidious, Palpatine, needs something like that to exist.
That's true, and I guess we sort of do at least get some justification for maybe a passage of time where this could have been being built, because we do get Satine having the hair kind of falling down, that new sort of more ragged look for her, and then we do also have, what was it, the guys whose name is totally escaping me right now, the dudes dressed like King Tut from back in Corruption are back, so Almec has sort of opened things back up to the black market trade again in the time since the last episode, presumably. So I guess there's got to be at least a little bit of a gap. It just seems odd that there's no mention of them.
As we know, in Star Wars, time is a very fluid concept.
Speaking of time, is it me, or did Satine's hair not just change the way it was animated, but it seems like it was significantly longer in this episode versus last week? Was that supposed to be some passage of time? It was very much a little crop cut last week, and now it's longer and obviously messed up because she's a prisoner, but it seemed like it was more than just out of place, like it was longer. Are we supposed to assume this is many months or a couple months and not just like, hey, 3 days later, Obi-Wan's here?
It was just pulled back before, right? The hair?
Well, that's just it. It seemed like it was more than just not pulled back or out of place, like it was noticeably, and maybe that's just it. Maybe it's supposed to just look rougher because, yep, she's been in prison for a short amount of time, but I kind of thought maybe that was a passage of time, you know, in place of just Maul and Savage Opress's horns being longer or something. But, you know, there's a little bit of a sense that, hey, much time has passed. This isn't just Darth Maul kills Pre Vizsla on a Monday and Obi-Wan shows up on a Thursday and Sidious cuts them all down on a Friday.
Regardless of the passage of time, but I really like this look on Satine. She really looks down to earth. She's kind of lost that regal talk that she had, but she looks really beautiful.
Kenobi arrives on Mandalore, and the twilight is back, although it definitely seems a little bit the worse for wear, like it's been kind of sitting around rotting somewhere, and Anakin hasn't had the time to, upkeep it. And we do like seeing the Rako Hardeen armor coming back, and it's kind of funny because the helmet that he uses is actually the prototype helmet for Boba Fett, which then kind of morphed into all the Mandalorian helmets, so kind of comes full circle. And he kind of comes down, and the Mandalorian comes up to him and asks him for his landing permit. He brings him up into the ship, and it was very episode 4. He steals his armor and comes down. I did get a chuckle when I saw that.
But this is a perfect look, though, for Obi-Wan as the Mandalorian, because, of course, we've seen him with the red astromech unit. We've seen him with the red-trimmed Jedi Starfighter. And here, because it's a super commando and the whole allusion to Maul, you've got Obi-Wan with these supposedly Maul colors that fit the way we've seen a lot of the technology accompanying him throughout not just this series, but also, of course, in Attack of the Clones and so forth. So I really thought this was one of the better looks that Obi-Wan's ever wound up with. Of course, it only makes sense for him to have it in this episode. But once he dons that armor, you can believe him being undercover, but being able to functionally use that stuff. He's got the bearing to carry it. Like, if they had stuck Satine in it, I'm sure that would have worked. But it really worked well for Obi-Wan.
Baron, you with me? We need this figure?
Oh, man. I was drooling over all the Mando figures. You know, Jerry, you had mentioned the Darth Maul horns, and I don't see how they could not make that figure. I don't see how they could not make that figure with the red Mandos and my blue Mandos fighting each other and my Mando transports.
Maybe we'll see some cool things at Toy Fair, but there's a small part of me wondering if we'll see any Clone Wars figures again ever. But what do you think about the Mando that's just so easily swayed that not only am I going to follow Maul now because he cut Pre Vizsla's head off, but man, I'm going to put some horns on my helmet. That's how into this I am.
Maul did defeat what they considered the strongest in the Mandalorian, so it's only fitting that they would emulate him.
At least he didn't cut off his legs.
You know, there's always that one guy of your friends, you know, who goes overboard. You know, you have the football party and everybody's wearing their jerseys, and there's always the one guy with the eye makeup. That's who this guy was.
Obi-Wan sneaks into the city, and he's observed by Bo-Katan, who stops one of her fellow night owls from shooting him. Why don't you think she helped him then?
would there have been perhaps a question of which side Obi-Wan was going to take? I mean, kind of let's see how this stuff plays out. I mean, it wasn't Bo-Katan per se that called for help. So I'm kind of sitting there wondering, well, you know, maybe this is a situation where, you know, somebody's shown up. It's a newcomer. Maybe they don't recognize who it is. And if they do, okay, what role is the Jedi going to play here? Yes, he's going to supposedly help, but is he on our side or is he a new side in this whole mess that's been created? It seemed like it was sort of a cautious optimism, perhaps, on her part. You know, the trust but verify type of approach.
Kenobi rescues Satine. And again, it seems really easy to get people out of that jail. He just kind of walks in. And as he's walking out, I love that scene in the elevator where the guy's kind of quizzing him. And finally, when Obi-Wan doesn't have the answer, he just knocks him out.
Prisoner transfer from cell block 1138.
It reminded me of Episode 4's whole thing with, you know, they let us go, and the whole idea of putting the tracer on the Millennium Falcon. I mean, yes, they're able to fight their way through and escape, but part of me wonders if this is another part of Maul's plan of, well, you know, we're going to keep the security lax enough that when Kenobi does finally show up, he will be drawn out by trying to get Satine out there, and then I will have him and have my revenge and such. It seems like one of those things can be very easily explained away by Maul's machinations yet again.
See, the thing is I completely believe that the first time that Satine escapes prison, she's allowed to go. I didn't get the sense that the second time she escaped that they allowed that to happen. I felt like they were trying a lot harder to get her back the second time.
True that. True that.
So Obi-Wan and Satine make it to the Twilight, and they take off. And again, we see the Twilight's having problems, but Obi-Wan's able to get it to kind of fire back at the Mandalorians. And then we get another awesome use of the backpack rockets used to take down the Twilight. There's no question now that the Twilight is gone, and I couldn't help thinking Anakin's going to be pissed.
You know, the Twilight falling, this was a great episode for it to fall. I mean, I pretty much all forgot about the Twilight, you know, after we haven't seen it for so long. It was a perfect time to set her to rest, you know, have her blown up in an amazing fashion by a bunch of Mando commandos. So even the Twilight gets a honorable death.
And, you know, just like this arc winds up taking care of the, gee, what are we going to do if Savage is around? Well, get him out of the way. Even Filoni said Satine's existence was always meant for her to eventually die because of her connection to Obi-Wan and such. You know, we've got the, well, what about this pacifist group of Mandalorians? Well, that may not be the case anymore, thanks to the status quo being upended in this episode. So that continuity issue may be dealt with. And now we've got the, well, why doesn't Anakin have this Twilight ship in any of the other stuff continuity issue? That's dealt with now, because now that thing's toast. They're kind of clearing the decks. They said they were going to. They said eventually they would wind up finding a way to nicely dovetail all this into Episode 3, and slowly but surely all these things that appeared new that we kept saying, how is it possible that these show up now and don't wind up having an effect later? They're just kind of sweeping them aside in grand fashion here.
So after the Twilight is destroyed and Obi-Wan and Satine manage to escape and hit the landing platform, Maul arrives and he just takes down Obi-Wan. I know Obi-Wan was probably a little hurt from the explosion, but Maul force pulls him, just rips the saber out of his hand, and doesn't even bother to duel him. Just completely overpowers him. And again, we start to see just how much Maul might be coming back to himself and really regaining his power. I thought that was just impressive. And then we transition to the Mandalore throne room, where Maul is touting the power of the dark side and telling Obi-Wan that if he really wanted to be powerful, he should have embraced the dark side, and he's taunting him.
Now, this is where everything changed for me for Maul, in my thinking of Maul, because up to this point, I'm rooting for Darth Maul. You know, we all love Darth Maul in Episode 1. They brought him back, and I'm rooting for Darth Maul this whole entire time, all the way back to the Knight Brothers to when he first comes back. I'm rooting for Maul to be the Maul that I remember. This is when I stop rooting for Maul, because he's torturing Satine, he's torturing Obi-Wan, and now he is the reason why you can hate him. You can hate, he's ultimate evil. So Maul is force choking Satine, right? The whole time she's choking, the tension is being wrapped up. He brings out the Darksaber, force pulls Satine over to him, and plunges that Darksaber right in the middle of her chest. Am I the only one on this call who said out loud, I was watching it with my son Pharaoh, and I said, they killed Satine! I couldn't believe it.
I gasped. I wasn't going to be surprised if they killed her, but the way they did it was intense.
I got goosebumps.
Knowing it ahead of time, I wasn't shocked, but I was incredibly impressed with the way they play that scene out. I mean, there is no dangling her in front of him type of thing. You know, he's choking her, but she's not up in his face. You know, it's not the her pleading kind of stuff, at least not for the most part. And then we just get that moment of just zoom forward, stab her with the Darksaber, the thing that Vizsla had never been able to do, another spitting on his grave at this point, and then just the emotional moment there of, again, Obi-Wan and Satine, which I think, I saw this, I think first was Big Shiny Robots, their review had mentioned this, and going back and looking at it, I think it does mirror Satine with Ewan McGregor, of course, in Moulin Rouge, and just the music playing, I mean, everything, especially the music, made that scene one of the highlights of the series. I mean, even seeing this coming and knowing that Obi-Wan can't give in to the dark side entirely or anything like that, you know, I was moved to the point of, I wouldn't say tears, but certainly got a bit verklempt on this one. It was an amazingly well-done, well-orchestrated little scene there, and it's probably, what, a minute, 2 minutes of the entire episode, and yet that was the emotional explosion, the buildup that's been building up since we first met Satine back in the day and figured, oh, something bad's probably going to happen because, you know, she's caught up in the middle of this and she's trying to stay neutral.
This is the moment where I guess I'm realizing this series has really hit its stride. Because you're right, Nathan. They spend just the right amount of time on this. They don't dwell on it, but they don't brush it under the rug either. And if this is the type of storytelling that they're going to do, I want Clone Wars to go on for years.
I agree with you, Jonathan. And this scene right here will dispel, hopefully, when people say, oh, they'll never kill Ahsoka. It's a kid show. They'll kill Ahsoka, all right? If this is what they're doing, this is how they're wrapping things up, they can and will, if they want to, kill Ahsoka. Don't worry about it. It's a kid's show. They'll do it.
Jonathan, I'm with you on the thing that they've hit their stride, sort of. Certain writers in the series have hit their stride of storytelling. They're certainly hitting the visuals. I mean, they're really able to capture a cinematic feel in a very short amount of time. But they still make the decisions to put stuff on the air like A Sunny Day in the Void. So they've hit their stride in excellence, but they're, or I guess Lucas's, because Lucas was the one who was pushing for the Mobius-style Sunny Day in the Void, they still have some bizarre creative decisions behind the scenes, which I guess some would say about the prequels. Those who are big prequel detractors would say that the effects and the universe itself had really picked up speed, but Lucas made some questionable decisions in that process too. It's just, how do we get this now? These four episodes, if you include the opener of the season revival, just, you know, shortly after the last episodes that we got. How does that happen in something that has this kind of quality level creation team behind it? It boggles my mind how that can play out like that. I mean, yeah, every television series has its down spots in a season, but to go from those extremes, that's, I can't think of other television series to have quite that big of a gap between its best and worst in a given season by the same general creative team.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing I'm a little nervous about is, and Nathan, I think you explained it well. I mean, it's a stride in the sense that they're demonstrating that, yes, we can do a single arc, a couple episodes, however you want to see it, with just the gold standard of excellence. But 22 episodes a season, X number of seasons, you're going to get a lot of crap in between the golden childs, right? I mean, you're going to get just the occasional awesome, which takes me back to my original point. They wouldn't have achieved this without the Darth Maul connection, without having something so big like, hey, we're really going to do something crazy and bring back Darth Maul because that's all we got. And I don't know if that's just a fundamental issue with being, you know, a TV show that takes place in between two well-established trilogies of movies. There's only so much Well, I mean, they're not right in between the trilogies, you know what I mean? I mean, they're between 2 and 3, but there's so much that bookends what this show can be that they have to either create all new heroes for you to be that emotionally involved in, or they got to do something that you just didn't see coming, like bring back Darth Maul. And they don't have that many rabbits except their sleeves. That this is it. I mean, I don't know what else they do other than, Barrett, like you said, all right, now is when we start playing with Ahsoka's fate, because they've established her. She can be isolated in and out of this series. Rex kind of, he can be as well. And it's kind of interesting. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but like, this has been a weird season because we've not seen the A players very much. We've not seen a lot of Anakin. We've not seen a lot of Obi-Wan. We've not seen a lot of Yoda. This has been R2-D2 season, Ahsoka, but then it's been all these new people, all these Clone Wars series specific characters that have been really carrying the season.
Let me try a fair comparison here, hopefully. It seems as though this series does amazingly well now after 5 years at the arc episodes, the mythology episodes, I guess the old fans of X-Files used to call it. When it's the stuff that's part of the broader arc, they have so many different cool seeds planted. They can create an episode like this that ties them together into something amazing. When they do the sort of one-off stories that don't have that broader connection, that's when we get stuff that kind of flounders, like what we got back with the droids episodes recently. It almost feels like it's time for them to really say, okay, we're kicking it into high gear with the Clone Wars. There is no need. The status quo is upended. We don't need the little standalone stories anymore, even if they're multi-episode arcs to fill some space, because we've got all this cool ground we've laid. Now let's rock and tie all those loose ends together. You know, essentially, let's be season 4 of Babylon 5, not season 1, so to speak.
So what you're saying is that they've done their world building, and now it's time to play in it.
Exactly.
After Satine dies, and Darth Maul says that he never intended to kill Obi-Wan, he just intended to make him suffer like he suffered. I thought that was just profoundly evil, and again, you know, Jerry, as you said earlier, when I first heard that Maul was coming back, it was kind of like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Really? But I'm extremely glad to be proved wrong. I think that they've done amazing things with him.
Before we leave this scene, because I know there's a lot still for us to cover, I mean, was anyone else surprised that Obi-Wan pulled out the, I know where you came from? I mean, we kind of joke that it's the, you don't know me kind of thing, but it's the, I see where you came from. I understand that the dark side was not a choice for you, that he's essentially appealing to Maul's basic, for lack of a better term, humanity, when, you know, we haven't seen a lot of that evident in him, but we certainly saw Maj go from being essentially an innocent knight brother, so to speak, and to becoming that monster. I never would have expected Obi-Wan to appeal to the humanity of Maul, of all people, and yet it worked, I think, in the scene, although it really just worked to enrage Maul from a practical perspective.
It's kind of Obi-Wan's the ultimate negotiator, right? I mean, he's even going to try to negotiate, so to speak, with Darth Maul. Doesn't get him far, but...
What did he think was going to happen?
You're right, I've done terrible things. Oh, wait a minute, that was Kid Boba Fett, never mind.
It could have worked with Savage, I think, because at the end, when Savage is dying, you know, he says to Maul, I was never like you. And that was so profound that you have, on one hand, you got Maul, who is this rage that it would never worked out with, but it might have worked with Savage. And I like that he was trying to talk to his humanity, as you say it, Jonathan. And is there anything in Maul's history that says that he got chosen, he got picked out by the Night Sisters just like Savage did? Or was Obi-Wan just kind of pulling it out of the air to see if it was in fact true?
He wasn't chosen. If you go with the Darth Plagueis novel, and Sidious was on Dathomir for some other purpose, and somebody gave him the baby Maul. I assume Maul's mother just gave him to try to save him from the Night Sisters. And Sidious had Maul from an infant and basically molded him. If you want to look at it from that perspective, Maul never had a chance. He never had a choice. It was always his destiny was decided for him, up until the point where he, quote-unquote, died on Naboo.
So it's just like what we know from Obi-Wan. What he said was true from a certain point of view.
I wondered if he was trying to unhinge Maul, kind of get him to lose control and lose focus and directly engage him and give him the opportunity to take him out. That was what I was thinking when that scene was playing out. We then jump to Coruscant, and Sidious, as was stated earlier, seems like he's sensing something, that the balance may be changing, and he calls for his shuttle. And we find out, well, we assume at that point, but we find out he is going to travel to Mandalore. Obi-Wan is being transferred to the prison where Maul intends to just have him held so he can stay there and suffer and realize that he has failed the woman who loved him. But he is broken out by Bo-Katan, and we have another original trilogy callback when he goes, "Who are you?" And she's like, "I'm here to rescue you."
Amen. And what a rescue it is. I mean, it's not just going around blasting the other Mandos as they're fighting their way out. I mean, she does the whole thing with attaching one to the other and slicing into the jetpack so it would zip off and pull the other around. I mean, a very stylish scene here. Not sure it's the most practical in combat, but really fun to watch.
And it's so fluid. I mean, I'm jumping back to the animation. You look at the difference between this and season one, it's just so fluid. You don't question it. She just looks amazing while she's doing it, even though it is kind of stretching the limits of believability at times.
Did anybody else get the look that Bo-Katan gives Obi-Wan as she asks him, "Do you know how to use the jetpack?" And he says, "Well, I'm gonna be a quick learner." And the jetpack is obviously connected by magnets because we've seen how Vizsla took off his jetpack with the straps and she just kind of puts it on there. So I guess they needed, you know, to hurry it up a little bit. But when Obi-Wan flies off, Bo-Katan kind of gives him a look and she kind of tucks her hair behind her ear. Did anybody else get that she may have the hots for Obi-Wan? That there might be a future in this?
I'm not sure I got the hots thing, but I kind of got it as sort of course, knowing what we know by the end of the episode about the sister thing, sort of a, I see what my sister saw in him kind of thing, because didn't Satine, I mean, maybe she doesn't, I can't recall having seen it, but she does that little hair flip thing briefly, and I could have sworn that was something that was meant to be more meaningful than what I was thinking that it was just watching the scene. I kept thinking maybe that was supposed to be something as a callback to maybe a mannerism of Satine's as a hint to the whole sisters thing.
Barrett, you need to stop trying to fix up Obi-Wan, okay? He's not getting hitched in this series, man.
He needs to call somebody else my sweet besides Ventress.
So as they fly away, we cut to Sidious Landing. And wow, he must have a really fast shuttle. Because, what, he gets there in 5 minutes or so?
Jonathan, you mentioned toys before. I need this shuttle. I will bring back the rule of three for this shuttle. Have we seen this shuttle before? I don't think so. I think this is like a souped up Imperial shuttle?
No, I think we've seen this type of shuttle before, haven't we? But the Jedi are using it, and it's slightly different coloring. I think the basic model is the same, though. Isn't this the same shuttle that they used during that awful arc with the father, the sister, and the brother?
Yeah, I know what you're showing, but I think that the wings looked a little bit different, and the markings were definitely different. It looked like it had engraved markings on the wings, but the wing shape looked a little more angular.
Well, come on, it's the Supreme Chancellor. His ride's always going to be pimped, right?
Nathan, is this the same shuttle?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. I kept thinking that this was just meant to be the same shuttle that he would have used when we see him in Revenge of the Sith, going after burned up Anakin, but it had been a while since I'd seen that scene.
No, it's definitely a different design than that. I think it's the same type of shuttle, the same class of shuttle, as we've seen the Jedi using at times. That's sort of like the precursor to the Lambda shuttles of the original trilogy. But, Barrett, you're right. They really do need to make that shuttle.
And is that Eta shuttle that's been seen earlier in the series? I was just trying to figure out if there was another connection, perhaps, to Sidious.
And they definitely need to make a Darth Sidious figure with two red lightsabers. I mean, that might have been helpful if he'd pulled that out in episode 3, but have we ever known Sidious? I guess we've only seen him fight a time or two, right?
He had two different lightsabers in episode 3. He had two of them because he lost one in the fight with Mace Windu, and then he has another one with him when he fights against Yoda. So at some point he had both of them, and wasn't one of them like hidden away within one of the statues and such, that sort of thing? So it makes sense for him to have two here because he had two separately before, kind of like Maul in reverse.
I don't assume any Jedi or Sith Lord has but a single lightsaber necessarily, especially if you're Palpatine, may have a collection of them, but to wield them simultaneously, now granted, I guess he knew what he was going up against, and Savage Opress, Darth Maul, probably gathered through intel and knowing Maul, the double blade lightsaber, but you know, he did fight four Jedi, and maybe I guess he just didn't spare with him, but then again, it's not like he needed it because he took the first three out like in three cuts.
And did you guys see the featurette? Filoni even calls that out and mocks it. he says, you know, how Savage and Maul are fighting, you know, it's going to be a fierce fight because, you know, he's such a great fighter, et cetera, et cetera. You know, hey, you know, the Jedi certainly didn't put up that much of a fight. I found that hilarious. I was wondering if George was going to watch it and be like, Filoni, my office.
If you're following continuity, this does create a bit of an issue because in the novelization of Episode 3, it said that when Sidious came to Coruscant, he hid his saber in a giant statue, and it had not been released since he came to Coruscant as a senator. But obviously he has them here, so maybe that there's three sabers.
Or maybe they just don't give a crap what the book said.
That's probably more.
They'll retcon it later.
Although the book is awesome.
You know, I do want to say something before we get into the battle where Sidious takes care of business. I do want to say, Jonathan, that Republic Forces Radio Network was the first to report from our special Comic-Con show when I was able to ask Filoni about this rule of two. And he did say back in Comic-Con, and we reported it first, that Sidious was going to fix it. He was going to make things right. That he knew that this stuff was going on out there, and he was going to put a stop to it. Cue the fight.
Which is funny, though, because we just got the Darth Sidious novel with apparently input from Lucas that basically had a rule of three up until the end of The Phantom Menace. So even that whole thing, I mean, Lucas is providing information to others, and they're running with what he has given them, and you've got three at a time. So even Lucas is fudging this thing. Come on.
Now, before we get to the fight, there is something. When Sidious enters into the throne room, disposes of the two Mandalorian guards, and confronts Maul, and as you know from last week, I was waiting for this. Maul prostrates himself, calls Sidious master, and Sidious says he's impressed. And Maul says that he's done it all so he could return to Sidious's side, to serving him. I'm wondering, and I want to get your guys' opinion on this, was this Maul kind of BSing him? Or has this been Maul's plan all along? You know, through the use of Savage, through the use of Black Sun, has he been doing it all to get Sidious's notice and show him that he is still a worthy apprentice? He is a worthy successor to the title of Sith Lord.
I'm going to give it face value that when Sidious says, you know, how unfortunate that you're lying to me or trying to deceive me or however he words it, I'm going to give the show the face value that Sidious keyed his intentions and that Maul's just doing a good acting job, because when Sidious says that, Maul's like, master, what, you know, what do you mean? I'm going to give it to him because I would kind of think that if Maul just wanted to regain his place next to Palpatine's side, he would just bust it in and chop Dooku down.
Yeah, though at least they give you some reason to possibly be able to see it both ways, because he does, you know, rant about wanting to go after the Sith pretender Dooku, but never really says anything about wanting to get revenge on his master per se. But here he is setting up this whole master-apprentice dynamic with him and Savage already, so he's obviously assuming that in some scheme of things, Sidious is presumably out of the picture. I was just kind of expecting the music to bust in as soon as he talks about how, you know, I did this all for you, master. I was expecting Bryan Adams to pop in, you know, everything he does.
Everything I do. I do it for you. You know, Jonathan, that is a great question, because I've been asking myself that question, and I see, Jerry, I see how you want to give it the benefit of the doubt. Face value, Sidious knows, he can feel. He can feel all the way in Coruscant what's going on. He can feel his former apprentice's intentions. But at the same time, why is he faking it in the first place? There's no reason for him to kneel in front of Sidious. I mean, he's in power. He's already said to Obi-Wan, welcome to my world. So why even put up a front in the first place? Why not, when he felt, and this was another great callback, this is a presence I haven't felt since the line cuts off, just like Vader did. And then Sidious walks in. Why even put up a front? If you're going to know that you're trying to fool him and you're going to try to take him out, why not just, you're in my house now, let's fight? Why even front on it? So I believe it's both ways. I believe when Maul felt Sidious, his presence, and saw him come in, if he did have the intention of having revenge on Sidious, I think it went out the window. And I think he reverted back to the apprentice. And that's just what he's used to. My master.
Surely he knows at this point how powerful Sidious is, and that if he doesn't grovel a little bit, he's probably dead. I imagine this being very much like Serenity, right? The I felt a presence that is very interesting. Define interesting. Oh God, we're all gonna die? Because that's pretty much what we're expecting here. You know, I can't imagine Maul thinking that at this point in his ascension, he is even remotely on the same level as Sidious and able to actually take him out. You know, if there's a way to avoid getting killed right now to plot again another day, he pretty much has to take it, doesn't he?
I'm just going to say, looking at it from another perspective, Maul fell. He failed to do his master's bidding. He failed to kill the Jedi and force Naboo to, you know, acquiesce to the Trade Federation. He was not able to do what his master directed him to do. He was mortally wounded. He went into hiding. Now, if he wants to get back into the good graces, he would have to prove himself worthy. He would have to prove to Sidious that I am still valuable. See, look what I can do. Look what I can provide. Even without you, I was able to reestablish myself. I am worthy. I am a better choice for an apprentice than the old man Dooku.
I cannot disagree with that, Jonathan. And I cannot disagree with you either, Jerry. I think it was a little bit of both. I think that he was trying to fool him at the end, but I think it's just the presence of Sidious coming in just kind of took him by surprise, and he didn't know what to do.
What I wish I'd paid more attention to, you know, now that we're kind of talking about this again, I wish I'd paid more attention to Savage's expression, if we could see it at that moment, because this seems very much like when Qui-Gon tells the Jedi Council that he'll train Anakin, and Obi-Wan's like, what? You know, what about me? Kind of the look that he gives, that look of, oh, what did you just do? You know, you got to wonder what Savage is thinking here in that, you know, if Maul is going to go back to Master Sidious, even if it is a ploy, then where does Savage fit into all this? Again, you got the whole issue with the Darth Plagueis novel that could have a master and an apprentice and someone who's essentially the battering ram for them being played into the idea of thinking that they might be a Sith Lord on equal someday. But still, you know, it seems as though Savage's impressions of this would have been very interesting to see. And yet, you know, he's right there beside Maul, you know, protecting him in the fight. It doesn't seem as though this potential change in Maul's attitude, whether ploy or real, has that much of an effect that we see outright with Savage. I'm wondering if there were any subtle, you know, little motions or anything from him, an expression on his face that I just missed. Was there anything that we noticed?
There was. When Darth Maul is on his knees and he's talking to Darth Sidious, you can see Savage kind of pacing behind Darth Maul, kind of looking, not really saying anything, but he is pacing. And he looks uncomfortable.
I mean, I'm just thinking back to Dooku had maybe not an apprentice, but he had a disciple in Asajj Ventress. So it wouldn't be that different here for Maul to explain Savage's presence to Sidious.
Well, you got to remember, Dooku did call Ventress his apprentice, and Sidious made Dooku kill or try to kill Ventress because Sidious was saying, hey, you know, you took on an apprentice yourself, and she's getting a little bit too powerful. Are you trying to take my place? I mean, it was something like that.
So then we move into the fight that everybody has been waiting for. Jerry and I saw a preview of this at Celebration 6. Everybody was completely psyched for it. Was it everything you guys dreamed of?
Yeah, I would say that it was, if nothing else, just fascinating to see Sidious in action in this series. I mean, it's kind of one character that if you'd asked me in before the series or maybe even that movie came out in 08, this would be a great opportunity to show more of what Sidious could do with the lightsabers. Like, oh, well, I don't really think it's going to go there. So, again, thank you for bringing Darth Maul back, though, so we'd have a really good excuse to do this, because you couldn't do this with anybody else. This wouldn't happen any other way. The fight was phenomenal. I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure if it was as good as the one from last week. I don't know, there's something about one-on-one fights that, to me, are a little bit more interesting and exciting and a little bit more dramatic. Maybe it's because that there are certain aspects of this fight, this duel, that I just wasn't sure if it was believable. I mean, I know Sidious is like the bad dude of bad dudes, but you think about just pure physics. And, you know, there's some things about where it didn't really seem like he was exerting force power. Maybe he's just so great he doesn't, it's not obvious. But you've got him blocking Darth Maul on one side, Savage Opress coming full force, and he just places his lightsaber behind his head and completely stops him still. So there's parts of that fight that to me were a little, okay, you know, even Sidious would have probably been pushed down there. You know, to me, it, I don't know, maybe it's just, there wasn't enough oh, what's the word I'm looking for? There wasn't enough belief in me that Sidious was going to do anything other than just go in there and whoop these guys up. It's almost like watching a Super Bowl, a timely topic, but it's like watching the Super Bowl where one team just blows out the other team 34-6. You're just like, oh, well, that sucked.
You know, Jerry, I saw what you saw, that Sidious didn't seem to be putting in the effort that Maul and Savage were. And I took it a little bit differently. I interpreted it as he is so powerful, he is so immersed in the dark side, that the outcome of this conflict was never in question. This didn't cost him effort, that he was able to draw on the power of the Force to reinforce him, so he didn't have to exert himself like they did. And that he was almost playing with them, because you just saw him. It was very much reminiscent of the fight between Sidious and Yoda, where he's just, I mean, without the cackling. He's just enjoying the fight. He's having fun while those two are fighting for their lives.
I understand what you're saying. He's not fighting Mace Windu here. He's not fighting Yoda to where, yeah, he put effort into those fights. That was a battle. But I think he put a little bit more effort in taking out the first three Jedi in his office. I mean, it just seemed like there was a little bit more effort. The outcome's not in question because we obviously know. But at no point did I ever feel the drama because, you know, it's not like Sidious had to, you know, really fight. And to me, I think it would have been a little bit more satisfying if even after Sidious was done and before he started frying Darth Maul, if he had wiped his brow a little bit and said, wow, you are powerful. I really got to zap you now.
But he did, really, though. I am not sure. I saw the fight a little different than you and Jonathan did. Because Darth Maul gives him a couple good kicks, and there's one scene where he force pushes Darth Maul back, but Sidious is breathing very heavily. He is exerting himself. And I can't remember, but I believe it was the novelization of Episode 2, where Anakin and Dooku were fighting. In the movie Attack of the Clones, when they're fighting and the lights go out, they're doing their lightsaber battle. It's not explicit that they're both tapping into the Force to fight each other. But in the novelization, it kind of goes to explain that, how they're both tapping into the Force in order for Anakin to be able to keep up with Dooku. So I can see what you're saying, Jonathan, how he's just so immersed in the dark side that it looked like he wasn't giving any effort. But I think that it was just a different type of effort. He was using the dark side, and he was loving the fact that Darth Maul and Savage Opress hated him. You could tell he wanted to say, yes, use your anger, because he was cackling. And I love that when the lightsabers crossed in front of his face, that was a very good callback to Return of the Jedi. But again, I think that I saw the fight a little bit different. I think he was exerting a lot of his energy to bring these two guys down. But once he separates Maul and Savage, I think he was able to take one lightsaber-wielding foe out pretty easily.
Well, it does seem as though, you know, he enjoys the fighting. I always kind of think back to that scene where he's sort of pulling back, almost as if to stab, but the blade is up closer to shoulder level in Revenge of the Sith, where just the glee on Ian McDiarmid's face as Palpatine, as Sidious, is showing there as he's fighting against Mace Windu. That always pops to mind in this. Yeah, it sort of seemed as though he was exerting himself at some points, but I mean, again, I'm kind of like, I'm with Jerry. The outcome wasn't really in doubt. It's just a question of ones were going to die, and having heard the spoilers before, for me, there wasn't even that aspect of it there. I will say that I think last week's was more fun than this one to me, because I like the other elements that Vizsla brought to it other than just the lightsabers and the Force. But this really was a kick-butt battle, no pun intended. We got to see, you know, these two going at each other. We got a cool moment where we get to see Darth Maul fighting with two lightsabers, where one of them is the regular lightsaber, the other is the dark saber, which was kind of cool. So we get those different effects as he's fighting, as he's twirling, the lightsaber acts differently than the dark saber. And it felt to me very much like a Qui-Gon Jinn death move when we finally do get the death of Savage. Because, you know, I think back to the Phantom Menace, and there's that, you know, hitting with the hilt to the face or to the chin by Maul. Then he turns and stabs while facing the opposite direction. And here we get a move that essentially stuns Savage briefly, and then boom, two lightsabers in a very similar fashion. They played this out in a way that was thrilling, just didn't necessarily have much of a stake in, ooh, what's going to happen? But they had enough of the, you know, the callbacks and the other elements in it that it felt fresh, while at the same time having those elements where he said, yes, this is classic Star Wars. This is what Lucas talks about when he talks about the chorus and the different beats, you know, the repeating themes musically within Star Wars, thinking of the storytelling as a song in and of itself. I really enjoyed it, though it's a little frustrating now to see some of the conversations being held in some places as far as, well, when Savage is dying and he's shrinking down and all the green spirit aura is coming out. I mean, that's kind of just something that Filoni seems to have passed off as well. He's reverting to his former state because he's dying. There's a lot of is that mist actually Mother Talzin in mist form coming out of his body? And it was really Talzin inside and all kinds of... There's a lot of speculation that seems way kind of off the deep end on the whole green mist thing. Might have been nice if he had just died. Or if perhaps instead of just seeing, I think we see part of the mechanical arm just sitting there after he shrinks. Would have been kind of neat if maybe he had shrunk down and Maul was left just holding the hand with the arm not attached to anything, because that is the hand that he's holding when he's down. So good scene overall. Just interesting the way that fandom can read into things. I'm sure I'm just as guilty as anyone.
I think I like how it isn't concretely stated what is. It kind of gives us a chance to speculate. I mean, thinking back to what we said at the beginning of this fight is, did he want to sort of retake the role of apprentice, or was he looking to survive or even depose Sidious? I think that's one of the things that makes this series enjoyable for me, is that there are no concrete answers. I'm able to look at it. I'm able to predict. I'm able to impress my own opinions and perspectives on it. But coming back, when he defeats Savage and Maul then goes at Sidious, and Sidious ultimately defeats him, he tells him he's not going to kill him. He has another use for him. What do you guys think that is?
Season 6.
Yeah, it's the entire justification of why Disney wants this show on XD next year. Yeah, I mean, I stated this earlier, and I think it's all down to the crime syndicate. I think Sidious likes what Maul has done, and I think he's got use for that, and probably thinks that he needs to maintain Darth Maul to run it. Not sure how. Not sure if there's a brainwash, some, you know, like he's going to set someone else up to defeat Maul so they can take it. I mean, who knows? But I think it has something to do with that. I mean, what else could it be?
I don't know. Remember, Sidious's ultimate goal is to wipe out the Jedi at the end of the Clone Wars, so maybe Maul will be a sacrifice to do that. Maybe we'll even see him fit in before the end of this season, because there is something that occurs in the next episode, and we'll get to that a little bit later.
You know, for me, when he said, I have use for you, I'm not going to kill you, I have use for you, that surprised me. I thought that Maul was goner. You know, when he's riding the lightning, I thought he was gone. And then when I started thinking about what could he use Maul for? And Jerry, honestly, the only option that comes up is that Maul has built this empire and he's going to use it. You know, what else could he use him for? Will he take him to Coruscant and parade him around? This is the Sith that you've been looking for. You know, that's never going to happen. So what else could he use him for? He has to be able to use him as maybe Maul's going to be the Emperor's first hand, Emperor's hand or something.
So we skipped over it, but Bo-Katan does help Obi-Wan escape. And she tells him as he's leaving to let the Republic know what's going on Mandalore. And Obi-Wan looks at her and says, well, that will mean a Republic invasion of Mandalore. And she goes, well, at least Mandalore will survive. So I don't think we've seen the last of the Mandalore arc in the Clone Wars.
Yeah, Bo-Katan says, Maul will die, but Mandalore will survive. We always survive. Great line.
But is it necessary even now? If Maul and Savage are gone, then is it even necessary for the Republic to invade? You know, if Bo-Katan lets Obi-Wan know that, no invasion necessary in theory. So we could wind up with not needing to see this arc continue at all. This could be the climax of it and just the cutting off of the Mandalorian side of things. Maybe we get another friend in need where it just sort of glances on it one episode in the season and that's it.
Nathan, not necessary, but a good excuse if Palpatine / Sidious wants to take control of that world and its warriors.
Oh, sure. It just wouldn't necessarily be the Jedi going along with the report that, you know, Obi-Wan's bringing back who'd be pushing for such a thing. It wouldn't be a justifiable invasion anymore.
Okay, well, this is what we've thought of the episode. Let's hear what some of our listeners thought about the episode. We have a lot of voicemails to go through tonight.
Hey, Republic Forces Radio Network, this is Zach, and I'm here to talk with you about The Lawless. And
Oh, I think I said that Shades of Reason was my favorite episode of this series. I have one complaint about this episode. It was way too short. In like an hour long special or something. But anyways, what a great episode. And seeing Obi-Wan in Mandalorian armor was just so cool. And man, I just never thought they would do something so cool as to kill Satine in that way in front of Obi-Wan. That was hard to watch. I almost shed a tear myself. But and just wow. And the fight with Sidious, wow, what an incredible fight. I mean, it was everything that I wished and hoped it would be. And I mean, just the way he just went in there and went like, he just showed that why he is the true Sith Master and Darth Maul is not. And it was amazing that Darth Maul was asking him for mercy at the end. And, there is no mercy or whatever he said. But, yeah, it was so cool. And if you didn't like the fight with Sidious, then you've got the Mandalorian fight going on outside. All right, that's my thoughts on the episode. Bye.
I didn't really like Darth Maul begging for his life like that. I would have almost preferred something more like, okay, you win, just go ahead and kill me. Something where he's a little bit more tough about it versus kind of whiny. It's like if everything you've done the last four episodes, counting, the premiere, you're going to go down like a punk. Come on.
It goes back to what Obi-Wan said. Only a coward would use the dark side, would choose that. And then we see that when a push comes to shove, Darth Maul is a coward. And again, Jerry, I'm not sure how I feel about that, because I don't want Darth Maul to be a groveling coward. I want him to be a mighty gladiator and take his punishment, just like Vizsla did. Vizsla fought, he lost. He says, only the powerful will rule Mandalore, and took his medicine like a man. And what does Darth Maul do? I don't know. It didn't sit right with me.
I'm going to echo what you guys had said. It didn't fit with the character, or at least the character I thought of when thinking of Darth Maul.
Threw me off a little bit, too, although I guess I put it in the context of when we met him as Spider-Maul, and his mind was virtually gone, and sort of the idea of maybe it's the whole concept of trying to not go back to that. The last time he was seriously defeated and essentially facing death, he wound up locked away for over a decade and losing his mind, basically. Only now he's got the opportunity to wind up facing that same thing again. Maybe he can beg his way out of it. I was hoping that maybe it was essentially a callback to him being sort of broken on the inside, more so than many Sith would be because of what he's been through.
Hey, Republic Forces, this is Ryan. Just given my thoughts of The Lawless, the newest episode of The Clone Wars, the finale to the awesome Maul and Mandalore arc, possibly the best episode of the series, probably is just a great episode. I get into my thoughts of what happened. I guess the relationship between Bo and Satine at the beginning of the episode when I was watching it was just one of being Bo being a political leader. But that didn't really happen. Turned out they were sisters. And later, after they capture Satine again, and Obi-Wan goes to try to save her, it was cool to see Rego Hardeen's armor and the Twilight come back again. Just cool to see, they're mixing in just little bits of all the arcs, kind of. Not all the arcs, but most of them together into this one big three-episode arc that has lots of stuff in it. After Obi-Wan rescues Satine and they go to the Twilight, it was sad but cool to see the Twilight explode. The Twilight was a really cool ship from way back in season one. Really enjoyed the ship, but it kind of needed to go because it wasn't been here for a while and they just needed to kind of get rid of it. After they take Satine and Obi-Wan prisoner and they have them in the throne room, it was surprising to hear Maul say that he had no plans of killing Obi-Wan anymore, but instead he just wants him to feel his pain. So he kills Satine, and that was really surprising for me. I read the book before, and I was really surprised to see that she was killed. I didn't think that they would actually ever kill Satine in the show, but they did, and it was really surprising. And I sense that Savage has a little sympathy for Obi-Wan at that moment, because the way he says, should we just kill him now, just the tone of his voice, I just felt like there was a possibility that he did. And Satine saying that she loved Obi-Wan and him not saying anything was like, okay, she's dying, you're not going to say anything to her, but oh well, he was kind of shocked, I think. After Obi-Wan gets transferred almost to the cell, Bo-Katan intercepts them and rescues Obi-Wan, and they have that awesome fight between the two sides of Death Watch. I'm guessing on the docks, because that's where Obi-Wan takes off, before he asks Bo if Satine and Bo were sisters, and she kind of just didn't say anything, so you're led to believe that they are sisters, which is very surprising, and I'm going to go back and watch all three episodes back-to-back, see if it gives any clues of Bo saying that. Now I'm going to get into the end of the episode with the lightsaber duel between Savage, Maul, and Sidious, and I thought this duel was the best in the series. It wasn't that long. I heard from the Clone Wars Hangout that it was a longer duel and they had to cut it down for the episode to make it 22 minutes, but it was a really cool fight, the way they started in the throne room and ended on, like, the steps, I guess. It was Savage dying. I guess he got hit in the head and then stabbed twice through the chest. It made me really sad because Savage is probably my favorite character behind Ahsoka, who was created for the show, and I thought he was just awesome. But I guess he really had to die because he's not in, even mentioned anywhere else besides all related Clone Wars stuff. So he had to die, but seeing the magic that the Night Sisters had wear off on him was also kind of neat, to see him die in his original form. And it was cool to see Sidious then, just Sidious against Maul. Maul using the darksaber with his normal lightsaber, so it was four blades. And then Sidious gets the upper hand and says that he has no plans for killing Maul, and I guess that Maul might come back in the series, he might not, but I guess that Sidious has other uses for him, and I'm really interested to see what those uses are. They're not going to come this season. If they come at all, they'll be next season. So, yeah, that's my thoughts of that episode. I really loved the episode. I guess I'll just touch on quick next arc. I'm really excited for it, seeing the fate of Ahsoka. I saw the little clip at the Clone Wars Hangout. Really excited to see who blew up that little part of the temple, and I am very excited for this next arc beat, but it is the final one, only 20 episodes. And the question I have is, what happened to the Clovis arc? Are they just not going to air it at all? Are they going to air it in season 6? Are they going to show it maybe DVD? I don't know. But I really want to see those episodes, so I can't wait to hear what your thoughts are. And thanks for letting me call. Bye.
He made a lot of interesting points, but the one that stuck out to me was, does Savage Opress have sympathy for Obi-Wan? And it's not something I considered. What about you guys?
Man, this kid was on it. He's talking about reading the books, and he was on this, and he was on that, but it is absolutely true. You know, now that I think about it, when Savage does ask Maul, should we kill him now, brother? It was almost like he was saying, can we take him out of his misery now? And I can kind of see that.
And I will say that with the whole 20-episode season, everything I've seen says that, yeah, the Clovis stuff did get pushed into season 6. I had a chance to talk to Jason Fry a little bit and asked him, you know, since he's writing the episode guide for this, up to, I guess, the end of this season, I had to say, well, do we know anything about where the Clovis arc fits in and all this? He's like, well, you know, no idea, because it's, you know, they pushed it back. So just like Insider says it was pushed back, looks like all sources are pointing to season 6, assuming that it does indeed wind up on Disney XD.
Okay, and let's hear what our next caller has to say.
Hey, this is Zylix from the forums. I wanted to make my first call into the show. I have a few things to say about the last episode. I want to focus on things that kind of struck me as odd, and I think the thing that everybody's got to be realizing now is that this prison on Mandalore is hardly a prison. It's probably not even a prison in name. It's more like a place to go to socially network at this point. I think even in the beginning from Corruption, I remember Ahsoka being in there and chatting with her friends and scheming in a cell. I think there were like 6 of them in a single cell, and they had no trouble breaking out. And nobody seems to have any trouble breaking out of this so-called prison. And it's just funny. It's like it's literally become a trope of the planet Mandalore is this prison and going in and out of this prison. The other thing that's weird about this episode, this arc as a whole, that's also played other arcs and is, I think, the source of some of the discomfort about how quickly things move, And it has to do with how quickly entire populations are swayed and moved in this cartoon series. The first time I noticed this was in a Mon Calamari episode where the prince yelled at the whole population of Mon Calamari while he was hiding from behind some seaweed, and they all rallied to his side. And here is sort of the same way. The entire population monolithically moves in the direction of Death Watch, or the direction of the new prime minister and abandoned Satine. And it's just so awkward to think of a billion people changing course so quickly that I think the way the viewer ends up thinking is, gosh, this is all so convenient, this is all so quick. And it's something that the Clone Wars does over and over and over again. It treats the whole population of a planet as though it's a single character who's whimsically changes from one way to another. And the climactic battle of Palpatine and the two Knight brothers, of course, was absolutely fantastic, and I'm sure you guys have talked a lot about it on the review. The thing that is important about the battle to me is that it establishes Palpatine as a totally credible bad villain, really serious, very effective, very powerful. And it was always a bit questionable in Revenge of the Sith, you know, who is this sort of little simpy old man, and is he really all that he's cracked up to be? And this establishes him as completely legit. On the other hand, it makes him so legit that it kind of makes the scene where Darth Vader picks him up and throws him into the big pit a bit awkward. It seems like Vader, I'm not seeing as much worse than Maul, or much more skilled or gifted than Maul, although I'm sure that Nathan can point out how the development of these characters makes it so that Vader is far superior to Maul. It just makes the idea of him just picking up Palpatine and throwing him down the pit a little bit unreasonable, given that this man just personally kicked the butt out of two very, very serious Sith warriors. So that's kind of interesting. And somebody mentioned on your last show that Maul is upset because he was abandoned, and then somebody pointed out, well, he was cut in half. That's hardly being abandoned, and we'll point out probably what's obvious to everybody now is, look what happened to Anakin, right? He was cut up in multiple pieces, burned to a crisp, and Sidious personally flew out there to pull him off the lava pit. So I definitely agree, Maul was totally abandoned. One thing I was curious about is, regarding the Emperor, if maybe Nathan can mention this, is wasn't Darth Plagueis alive during Episode 1? So the Emperor himself, in our period of time, has gone from an apprentice to a master, if I have that timeline right. So that's all I really wanted to say. I just wanted to bring up some of the things that I thought were awkward, but of course this was the best episode yet, and it was also the most informative. And thank you guys for a terrific show. I listen to it every week.
Well, just to sort of pick out a couple of things there, I would say, on the one hand, the whole issue of Vader being able to essentially pick him up and throw him, don't underestimate the power of the no, because that really buffs a person's abilities. But on a more serious note, yes, as I was alluding to earlier in the episode, yeah, Darth Plagueis is alive during Episode 1, at least according to what Lucas provided that Lucino then put into the Darth Plagueis novel. So yeah, during Episode 1, it was actually Plagueis as the master, Sidious as the apprentice, and Maul essentially as their muscle, with the question of whether he would ever wind up actually being a true Sith apprentice. And by the end of the film, we've got Plagueis gone and Sidious as the new master, with Maul supposedly being the apprentice, only to find out, oh wait, he's dead. So now we have a master without an apprentice for at least a short time there. I don't want to give anything more about the circumstances, but as long as the voicemail there has already spoiled at least that one aspect of the novel, I think it's okay to confirm that here. So yeah, there's interesting dynamics going on with when there's an apprentice, when there's a master, when is the rule of two being broken, etc.
Hey RFRN, this is Ben Devis on the forums, back once again to talk about the incredible end to a truly remarkable arc, The Lawless. Now, much like the past two installments, the performances in this episode were absolutely fantastic, especially Anna Graves as the former Duchess Satine, the late Ian Abercrombie as Sidious, and the ever-impressive Sam Witwer as Darth Maul. Now, when I sat down to watch this episode this morning, I knew when the opening narration started to keep in mind the likelihood of some deaths in mind, but I did not see the reveal coming of Bo-Katan being Satine's sister. I mean, I want some backstory on that at some point. And I am very interested to see how Satine's death will affect Obi-Wan down the road. I mean, the music, the way it was done, and her ragged gasps, like all of that wrapped into one, that was truly touching. And just the way Maul sat back on the throne, smirking, oh boy, it's going to be really, really something to see if Obi-Wan and Maul ever cross sabers again. But while there is a lot to love about this episode, I mean, the one thing that I enjoyed but wanted to be better was the three-way duel between Maul, Sidious, and T'Vaj. Don't get me wrong, it was still a great fight scene, and I do still think it's some of the best we've seen thus far. But the intercutting of Obi-Wan and Bo-Katan flying around Mandalore took away from the effect. I mean, where Eminence and Shades of Reason were continuous, we didn't get that this morning, and I think it could have been even better had it been continuous, but it was still great. And Savage's death was downright surprising and even sad. I mean, I can't even describe it. I mean, when Maul goes over and holds his mechanical hand and he literally disintegrates, if that's the right word, all that freaky Night Sister mist evaporated. That was sad. I mean, he said it himself, he never was truly evil. He was just a product, a pawn in the games of Asajj and Mother Talzin. Aside from things I've mentioned, I'm very interested to see what Sidious has planned for Maul. And a little side note, if I could, which I'm sure you guys know about already, The Lawless was Mr. Abercrombie's final episode before his death. So, for what it's worth, this Star Wars fan would like to thank Mr. Abercrombie for his amazing performances as Darth Sidious. And well, that about does it. I mean, I, as always, can't wait to see what everybody thinks about this ending. And while this was, like I said, a truly remarkable arc, earlier this afternoon, there was the first ever Star Wars hangout with Filoni and Ashley Eckstein, Matt Lanter, and Sam Witwer, and I think Pablo Hidalgo. But Filoni himself said that the next four episodes, the next two arcs, are going to be emotionally wrenching. So I think we need to strap ourselves in, because we might not have seen the best of what Season 5 has to offer. So without any further ado, I think I'm going to go back up and watch The Lawless once again. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, Ben, one thing that I have to disagree with you personally is that I thought the whole intercutting of the lightsaber battle was very Star Wars. I loved how that was done. It wasn't so jarring like Episode 1, where you had like four battles going on simultaneously, and you almost forgot what the rotational order was, but going back and forth from battle here to battle over here was pretty well done. It was a good callback, but then I was invested in both events, so I thought it was pretty well done.
Hey guys, it's Will, otherwise known as Venator1229, known on the forums, calling about the most recent episode of Star Wars, The Clone Wars, The Lawless. And I must say, this episode was something else. It was fantastic. I mean, usually I'm a guy who likes, you know, clones versus droids action, but since there's been none of that this season, but this totally made up for it. This episode, I feel, has reached a new series has reached a new milestone with this episode. It was incredible. It was probably the darkest episode there's been this whole series. We have the death of, like, two somewhat major characters, Satine and Savage. Like, it was absolutely insane. But anyway, I have this kind of list of stuff I just want to, like, touch upon. So, when Obi-Wan is brought to Darth Maul, he says, "You can kill me, but you can never destroy me," which, you know, I kind of thought that kind of leads back to Episode 4, where it was like Obi-Wan saying that to, like, Darth Vader, except saying, like, if you strike me down, I'll become more powerful than, like, you could ever imagine, which I kind of thought that was kind of a throwback. The Twilight was destroyed, so much for that, I guess, unless that was a different ship, but he said he borrowed it from a friend, Anakin, so the Twilight's gone. And then to mostly touch up on Palpatine, now what I really liked about this was, like, it just kind of shows his office, just him kind of thinking. Then Mos Eisley comes in, he's just like, prepare my ship. And it was like, I thought that was like super cool. Like how, like with the music and everything, it was just super evil. Like stuff about to go down. Like that's what I thought. It was really cool. And then how like he was, when Palpatine got there, just like the slow Imperial march, it just sounded super dark and everything. And it was really cool. But anyway, during the duel, there was one thing I was thinking about was like how Palpatine was fighting those two and just like not really trying that hard. It kind of reminded me of Grievous back in the old Clone Wars series, just because he was taking them on and he just seemed like this super impossible enemy who's just super fast and like so much more skilled than everyone else combined. And how strong Palpatine was physically, like he was knocking Savage like 20 feet like without any problem. And it was really weird and really cool. And like I just thought the fight, it wasn't even fair. Like Palpatine, I don't think he was even trying. He was just like beating them down. It was just insane. And then lastly, you've probably noticed, we'll probably talk about this on the show, but the new voice actor came in after Palpatine beat Maul. And I don't know, like, I think he's questionable. Like, he wasn't bad, but, I mean, Ian Abercrombie's voice is much better. But who knows? They probably won't even have Palpatine much in the series anymore, just unless if there's, like, a huge opposition to Palpatine's new voice or so. But anyway, yeah, that's all I wanted to talk about. So, yeah. Guys. Bye.
You know, as much as I was hoping that the phrase Twilight is gone was that sparkly vampires were gone, I will say that one thing that sticks out to me that you'd mentioned there is the issue of maybe not having Sidious or Palpatine back that much with Ian Abercrombie gone. And I could see, you know, maybe the thought process behind that of, you know, sort of being true to his memory and such. But keep in mind, Sam Witwer, who is becoming much more of a part of this series thanks to Maul, and then back we had him for The Sun, he did the voice of Palpatine / Sidious in the Force Unleashed game. So they have someone actually there with them who is a proficient and apparently so far fan-accepted voice for that character. I would assume that's probably where they're going to jump to.
Hi guys, this is Anthony, and I'm calling in about the latest Clone Wars episode. And all I have to say is, wow, that was completely amazing. I really enjoyed the new prints that the Mandos had, the red armor, and I liked how their helmets were different than the old ones. Some of them, well, they all had handprints on them. Some of the designs were sideways handprint, and some were direct handprints. But one of them didn't have a handprint, and that was the one that Obi-Wan first encounters and steals his suit. I was kind of confused why he didn't have a handprint on his, but, and also that new horned Mando, he had the spikes on his helmet and his shoulder pads. I didn't know who he was. He was always hanging around Maul, but he was kind of cool. And I can't wait to see these characters in the upcoming Lego set that's coming out this summer. I guess we'll see some pics of that at the next toy fair, but it's supposed to have Maul and a couple Mandos and a speeder. And I really like the new weapons that were introduced in this episode, like the exploding darts that Bo-Katan uses. That was really cool. And the best part, hands down, about this episode was the battle. I could tell Sidious's pure joy when he was fighting those two. I mean, he was cackling with awesomeness because he hadn't, I don't think he's fought anyone with his lightsabers since the beginning of the trilogy yet, because even in the Darth Plagueis book, he doesn't fight a Sith with his lightsaber, so I'm not sure if this is the first time, but it was really awesome. And I watched the whole fighting sequence in slow motion, and it was actually really interesting because you get to see every single move in detail. And I liked how the characters used their lightsabers behind their backs to block other lightsabers so much during this sequence. And I was also wondering where Sidious keeps his lightsabers. I mean, whenever he pulls them out, it seems like they're coming out from his armpits. I mean, where does that guy keep them? But anyway, that was a great episode, and I am begging for a soundtrack. I mean, seriously, at the end of this series, we have to have a soundtrack of all the music. They just played it so wonderfully in this piece. Lastly, I really enjoyed the fight sequence for one major reason. In other fight sequences in the Clone Wars, we know what's going to happen to the characters. Say, Grievous battling Obi-Wan. We know that they're both going to survive because of the movies. But in this episode, we didn't know what on earth was going to happen to Maul or Oppress. That's what made it so enjoyable to watch for me, because I had no idea what was going to happen to the characters. even though I knew Sidious would survive, I didn't know what he was going to do with these two. So I really enjoyed how it played out, and right after, a few hours after I watched the episode, I went into Star Wars Battlefront 2, I have to admit, and I played as Sidious and was using Force Lightning to kill everyone because I was just so, I was so encouraged to play as Sidious in the game because I'd just seen him do such an awesome battle. And I just love this episode. So keep up the great work, guys. Thanks. Can't wait to listen to this episode. Bye.
You know, I liked a lot of the new things they introduced for the Mandos this time, too. The explosive darts, the blade coming out of her gauntlet. The one that I really liked, though, was when Obi-Wan is escaping, they had energy shields on their gauntlets. And that's something we hadn't seen before. I think that's just a real cool addition to the sort of the Mandalorian lore. Well, we'd like to thank everyone for calling in. We had, I think, a bumper crop of voicemails this time, and everybody seems to universally really enjoy this episode. As we've said in this episode, Clone Wars is really hitting its stride, and hopefully you can keep it going. But there's been some news this week about Clone Wars and its future. Cartoon Network put out its schedule for the fall, and surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, Clone Wars was not listed on their fall programming. So, there's been a lot of speculation. Nathan, Barrett, Jerry, where do you think we're going to see Clone Wars in the future?
Well, if you ask Big Shiny Robot, they're running a story actually right now, this evening as we're recording this, of a rumor that it is going to Disney XD, which seems like the logical place. Supposedly this comes from someone who was told that by a customer service representative when asking about where it's going to show up. I kind of doubt that that is the type of individual who would have that kind of information already at this point, probably just running on speculation and such, but it seems like all the speculation is being pointed specifically to Disney XD. I mean, where else would it go except maybe, what, ABC Morning Fair, perhaps, or something? I'm not even sure what ABC does. I'm so out of the children's cartoons loop at this point.
Well, I think from the moment they announced that Disney was purchasing Lucasfilm, Clone Wars was destined for Disney XD, and there's been no formal announcement. I can't imagine it's too far away, especially after this episode. People are chomping at the bit. They want more Clone Wars. The other thing that's come out recently is that this season is going to be short by 2 episodes. Nathan, is that confirmed?
Yes, I believe it is. We've got essentially a 4-episode arc based around the whole bombing and the Ahsoka on the trail and others on the trail of her storyline here for our last 4.
And stepping into Star Wars Action News territory, there's another rumor that the Clone Wars figure and toy line is going to be put on indefinite hiatus. Hopefully we'll get some more information later this week during Toy Fair. But I'd like to thank my fellow hosts for discussing this episode and this arc with me. Really enjoyed the discussions and some of the ideas and revelations that I've gotten to share with you guys. Next week, we'll be starting what is now the final arc of the season with Sabotage. Have a good night, everyone.
See you guys. See you later.
Blah, 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 Sabotage! Can't wait. Should be fun.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Jerry, Jonathan, Nathan, and Barrett. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademark, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2013, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.